I've never heard that song before. There are no orphans, the Lord there. I thought that was pretty good. I preached last Sunday about widows and orphans, and I had a lady today in the church say, "You were preaching about me." And when she told me that, I said, "You know, I didn't even realize that, but you're in both of those categories." And she was an orphan as a little girl, and I guess probably maybe a little over a year ago now, maybe 2 years ago, her fine husband went to be with the Lord. And so, Amalie, I appreciate you singing that song. Well, I call your attention to 1 Samuel 22. And I'm going to do my best to finish this chapter tonight. I've got it broken down into four sections. And I hope that if you take notes that you will jot these down. We'll begin in verse number 6. Now, we finished up last week with chapter 5 and the prophet Gad, which is one of the three prophets that were in David's life. Nathan is a prophet, and Samuel is the last prophet along with Gad. And so he tells him to depart into the land of Judah. And so what does he do? He leaves the hold at a place probably called, today we call it Masada. And he went to the forest of Harith. And so he has taken care of his parents. They are now living in the land of Moab. If you have a Bible map, you can look and you can see that Moab is quite a distance from where Saul is pursuing David. So he takes them to a place of safety. And so he leaves them there. I think the Bible is silent if David ever sees his parents again. He probably met them when he died. He was an Old Testament saint, and he met his folks who were Old Testament saints. But he probably in his life never saw his mom and dad again. At least I have not been able to find that in the scriptures. Well, tonight we pick up in verse number 6. The title of the message tonight is this: A Man After Saul's Own Heart. That's a little play on what the Bible says about David, who was a man after God's own heart. We're going to see a man tonight who was cut from the same cloth that Saul was cut from. When we began our series many, many months ago, I had a different view of King Saul. He had such a great opportunity at the beginning. But I'm telling you, with what he does tonight, I just do not see how this man can be a believer. I don't see how that even if he was a picture of a carnal believer, I just do not see it with what he allows to happen and commands to happen in our passage this evening. The first thing that I want you to look at is I want you to look at the power, the raw power that is exhibited in verse number 6 down through verse number 10. Let's read, and as we read, I'll do some commenting. And when Saul heard that David was discovered, he was found. Well, not only was he found, and the men that were with him. Now remember, how many men did David have at this time? He had 400. And who were these men? They were the losers. They were the people that had been in debt. They were the people that had been just discouraged. They had been people that had been in distress with everything that was going on in the land of Israel. And they came to David, just a tattered band of people, and they coalesced around this outlaw David. And so you'll see in just a little while a little bit about leadership and the different styles of leadership that we have between these two men. And so he is discovered. Now, where is Saul at? Saul is abiding in a place called Gibeah, and he's under a tree in Ramah. Now, Ramah is an area, and the trees that are predominant there is a tree called the tamarisk tree. This tree is a tree that it grows about 25 feet in height. It usually grows in groves, so it's probably not just one tree. He's sitting under one, but there's probably many trees, and his group of people, his royal court, so to speak, are probably underneath these trees trying to be as cool as they possibly can. The trees are really part of the cedar family. They're called a salt cedar. And so it's an area where they're trying to get out of the heat, and you find him sitting underneath this tree, and what is he holding in his hand? Well, he has a spear in his hand. Now, in ancient times, there were kings, and they would use a spear as their royal scepter. They also would use it for protection if they were insecure in their position. And so what you have is you've got this man that is just seething. He's not fighting his true enemies. He's just sitting there with a spear in his hand, maybe bouncing it on the ground. And his servants are around him, basically just standing there. Well, he begins to talk in verse 7. And he said unto his servants that stood about him, "Hear now, you Benjaminites." Now, I want you to underline the word Benjaminites. What that means is it means that they were from the tribe of Benjamin. What tribe was Saul from? He was of the tribe of Benjamin. And so what he had done is he had taken his army and he had put in charge those that were in the royal court, those people that were from his tribe. If we were going to use a modern day word today, it would be the word nepotism. My kids are constantly throwing that word up at me. Whenever they were young growing up, and they would say, "Hey, I want to do this," and I'd say, "You can't do that just because you're my kid. I'm not going to give you preferential treatment to use something at the church, because that would be nepotism." And so it's turned into a joke at our house. "Well, we can't do that because of nepotism." And so the kids razz me about that even now as they're grown adults. And so what you've got is you've got Saul that has a lot of nepotism going on with the tribe that he was born into. Well, as he begins to talk to these Benjaminites, he reveals why they're loyal to him. What does he say? "Well, the son of Jesse." Now remember that, because he's not only going to be called the son of Jesse, but he's going to call somebody else a son of. Whenever Saul begins to call somebody the son of, you know he don't like them. You know that there's trouble in store for those people if he can get his hands on them. And he said, "Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you captains of thousands and captains of hundreds?" In other words, whenever I gave you your position, I took some vineyards from a guy and I said, "That's yours now." I took some fields from some other Israelites and said, "That's yours now." I took you when you were not the most qualified, but I put you over 1,000. I put you over 100. You've got 100 men that you can tell to go do something, and they've got to do it. I gave you that power. So basically, for their loyalty, he bribed them. Well, you don't find that going on in the life of David. David did not seek out these 400 losers. He didn't seek out these 400 men along with their families to come and be with him. They came to him because they realized there was something special about him. The fact that God's hand of blessing was upon him, the fact that God had chosen him to be the king, was special. And so these people came to David. Saul's people had to be bribed. Well, he goes on and he begins to make an accusation against them, but then he pinpoints one specific person of the same tribe. Look with me at verse 8. That all of you, you guys that are right out there right now, the ones that I gave the vineyards to, the ones I gave the fields to, the ones that I gave you your commissions to, all of you have conspired against me. And there is none that showeth me that my son, I've circled the word my in my Bible because it uses the word twice. None of you told me that my son, Jonathan, had made a league with the son of Jesse. You kept that from me. Well, my guess is that many of them probably didn't even know it. But when you're mad, when you are filled with bitterness, when you have hatred, you get blinded. I don't think that these men were actively trying to undermine him, but when you have problems, sometimes you project those onto other people. And I think that's probably what is happening here, is he probably thinks these people have the same heart that I've got. Well, I don't think that they're quite as wicked as he is, and we'll see that here in just a little bit. And so he said, you didn't even tell me that Jonathan had made a covenant or a league with the son of Jesse. There's none of you that's sorry for me. He's on a pity party. And he said, and there's none that showed that my son has stirred up my servant against me. Can I tell you that's a bald-faced lie? Jonathan did not do one thing to try to hurt Saul. All he did was try to help David. And so, you've got him blaming his boy. Jonathan has tried to do nothing but good. He defended David because David had not done anything but good. And so, he says, you didn't even tell me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day. David is lying in wait for me. David is not trying to hurt Saul. We're going to see on a couple of occasions how that David could have killed him with no problem. I mean, no problem whatsoever. But yet, in his mind, he thinks David is just around the corner. And so with the spear in his hand, he's just beating the ground with it, making all these accusations. Well, Doeg, the Edomite, steps into our picture. Look with me at verse 9. Then answered Doeg, the Edomite. And what was he? He was the one that was set over the servants of Saul. Now look back with me one chapter to chapter 21, and I want you to look at verse number 7. Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day. Where's there at? Nob. All right? He was detained before the Lord. In other words, God had the circumstances happen where that he would be stationed at Nob or could not get away from Nob until he was able to see something. And his name was Doeg, an Edomite, the chiefest of the herdmen that belong to Saul. The Septuagint says that the herdsman there has the idea of the mules. So you've got Doeg that was the chief mule keeper, right? And so that's who we're talking about in verse number 9. He's not an Israelite, he's an Edomite. You say, well, how did an Edomite get to be in Saul's inner court, so to speak? Well, we won't go to it, but I think it's in 1 Samuel 14. Saul is beginning to do some battles. He's beginning to fight. And one of the groups that he fights against is the Edomites. You remember several weeks ago whenever I was doing the series on the other 12, and I preached on Obadiah and how that the Obadiah was preaching against the Edomites. And the last of the Edomites were killed somewhere around 70 AD, but God began to systematically get rid of that group of people. Well, Doeg was one of those Edomites. Well, when Saul fought against the Edomites, he probably took him captive, and this guy turned his allegiance from his people to Saul, and he made such an impression that he was put in charge of the mules. Well, he said, I saw the son of Jesse, now he's onto the son business, coming to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. So what is he doing now? He is stepping up because he sees an opportunity here. He's been kind of in the background. He's been listening to Saul berate the Benjaminites. And so you've got Doeg that is stepping up now. Why? Because opportunity has reared its head. And I want you to notice what he says about Ahimelech. And he inquired of the Lord for him, and he gave him victuals or food, and he gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. No context at all here. All right? Now we won't take time to go back and read it again. But if you are to do that, maybe at home tonight or sometime this week, you read the story of David coming to Nob and asking for food. And what does he get? He gets the showbread that is now being replaced because there's new bread that has been baked. And the priests are now to eat this showbread. But yet he gives David because he is a emissary of the king. Why? Does he think that? David lied to him. David said, I'm on the king's business. But he was not on the king's business. And David is going to take blame for something that's going to happen here in a few minutes. He's going to take the blame for that, and it's something that he will carry with him the rest of his life. And so, Ahimelech is an innocent priest. He's not tried to be disloyal to King Saul. All he's doing is he's just trying to do right. Here he is, he's just a country priest out in a place called Nob. He's got some other priests that are there. And there's at least 85 because 85 of them come with him to see King Saul. And so, Doeg says, he inquired of the Lord. Well, when you read the story earlier, you don't really find that, but evidently he did, because Ahimelech mentions that here in a moment. Look with me at verse 11. And then the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, and the priests which were in Nob, and they came all of them to the king. In other words, he brought 85 other priests with him. Well, Saul said, "Hear now, thou son of Ahitub." There's that son of again, all right? And he said, "Here I am, my lord." And Saul said unto him, "Why have you conspired against me, thou and the son of Jesse, in that thou hast given him bread and a sword, and hast inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait at this day?" And now what you have is you've got the priest that are pulled in. We've got the raw power of a king. Is he going crazy? Probably. Has he got some mental things going on? Yeah. But now he's pulled in innocent priest. You've got the high priest, and you've got 85 other guys that just try to serve the Lord. They wear what is called the linen ephod. Basically, it was a piece of clothing that marked them out as being a priest, which people, when they see it, they would say, "There's a man of God right there. That's a man of God." And so, he's being accused. And in verse 14, Ahimelech answered the king and said, "Who is so faithful among all thy servants as David?" In other words, why are you getting on me? I don't know what's going on. David comes, I think he's with you. I don't know about any problems that you've got. And he said, "Who's been more faithful to you than David?" I mean, Ahimelech knew about Goliath. He knew that David had been placed in charge of many, many missions and had succeeded in all of them. He said, "He's the king's son-in-law." In other words, he married a girl that you gave him. And he said, "He goes at your bidding. And he's honorable in your house." In other words, I just thought he was one of yours. "Did I then begin to inquire of God for him?" In other words, it was only when I thought he was with you that I began to ask God to bless him and intervene on his behalf. "Be it far from me. Let not the king impute or charge anything unto his servant, nor to all the house of my father, for thy servant knew nothing of all of this, less or more. King, I'm just out in the woods. I'm out in that little place called Nob. I don't know what's going on with you in your royal court. I don't know anything about you and David having any type of issue." Without even considering that, I want you to see the persecution that steps in. Verse 16. "And the king said, Thou shalt surely die, Ahimelech, thou and all thy father's house." That's a pretty harsh sentence. I mean, that's pretty rough for a guy that has just told you, "I didn't know anything. I mean, I'm from the sticks. And now you're going to kill all of us?" Well, the king turns to his footmen, to the guards that are close to him. And he says, "Turn and slay the priest of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not show it to me. 86 men are going to be murdered. They're going to be executed. Why? Just because they tried to help who they thought was the servant of Saul. Oh, but let me show you something. There are some times when orders are not to be obeyed. And I think this is one of those times. These guards, these footmen, all they knew that these men were innocent men. They knew that Ahimelech had not done anything. Now their king had made an order. He had given a command. But the servants of the king would not put forth their hand to fall upon the priest of the Lord. In other words, they were very careful not to touch the anointed of God. And I think that's a pretty well-known principle throughout the Word of God. You better be careful whenever you begin to trifle with the men of God. I know that there are times when men of God are not what they ought to be. But God can take them out just as easily as he set them up. But we need to be very, very careful about trying to make justice happen by our actions. I remember hearing this story. I think maybe Brother Non told this many years ago. There was a preacher that had a certain style car. And there were some people in his church that just really they were trying to get rid of him. So they found another car that looked just like his, and they parked it over next to a motel, next to a place of, not a very good reputation. And then they had a lady that came out and kind of stood next to the car, and somebody snapped a picture of it, and they said, "This is our preacher's car over at the such and such motel." It wasn't the preacher's car, but it looked like the preacher's car. And they made the accusation publicly, and that preacher walked to the pulpit, and as he began to try to talk, he had a heart attack and died because he was accused of something that he was not guilty of. If those people are Christian, the judgment seat is going to be tough. If they aren't Christian, and that's the way that I kind of lean, the great white throne judgment is going to really be tough. And so you've got these men, and they said, "We will not touch God's people." The world better be careful the way that it treats God's people. Because there's a judgment that's coming. Sometimes I hear people say things like this: "Oh, there's no such thing as a hereafter. I mean, when you die, you're like a dog. Nothing happens after that." I just can't buy that. And the reason is because where's the justice in it? You mean to tell me that somebody like Hitler, that killed over 6 million Jews. That doesn't include others. That's just 6 million Jews. That he can commit suicide in some bunker outside of Berlin and he doesn't pay for anything? Where's the justice in that? There's no justice there. Oh, but there's a God that's going to make things right. And that's one of the reasons that I believe in the hereafter, is because there's a God that's going to make things right. And that's innate. I mean, there's something inside of us. We're born with wanting things to be right. Did you know that it's been estimated that for every word in Mein Kampf, which is the book that Hitler wrote, they said for every word in that book, Hitler had 125 people murdered for every word. Oh, there's a God that's going to make that right. There's a God that's going to take people like Joseph Stalin, and he's going to make that right. Now, how is he going to do that? I know it's going to be the lake of fire. But I don't know what else God's got planned. I don't know what degree it is. But I'm telling you, you don't trifle with the people of God. And so you've got doing. The servants won't do it. And so the king says to Doeg, turn thou and fall upon the priest. So he did. He turned and he fell upon the priest, and he slew on that day 85 persons that did wear the linen ephod. When these priests came to see the king, they wore their priestly garment, the one that distinguished them from everybody else. And this vile man, Doeg, he kills 85 priests that day. But it doesn't stop there. We see in verse 19 something else. He doesn't just stop with the men. He goes back to that little place called Nob, the city of the priest. Smote he with the edge of the sword both men, those that were not priests, women, children, and sucklings. In other words, the newborn babies, he killed them all. Why? Because Saul told him to. He was a man after Saul's own heart. Saul cared nothing for innocence. And yet, you've got this man. He kills every human. But he even goes so far as to kill the oxen, the asses, the sheep, all of those with the edge of the sword. Somebody says, why would God allow that to take place? I don't know. The purposes of God sometimes are hard to understand. I don't always understand why God allows certain things. I know that all things work together for good to those that love the Lord. I know that. I thought about this in the last few days. You know, the president has just had a historic meeting with the leader from North Korea. Many years ago, outside of Seoul, Korea, which is in the south, there was a little village. And I don't know if you realize this or not, and I assume it's this way unless the Philippines has overtaken it. But at one time, the largest church in the entire world was located outside and inside, really, of Seoul, Korea, because it was not really a church congregation like this, because it was so large that they could not accommodate it. They had to have what they call cell groups. The pastor, when it became large, was a man named Paul Cho. But Paul Cho was not the man that started the church. The man that started the church was an unknown pastor. He was married, and he had two children. And outside of Seoul, it was back before Korea had split. And the communists had begun to come in, and they crossed over into this particular village, and they got everybody in the village. And they took this man and his wife and his two kids, and they had scooped out a hole with a bulldozer. They stripped the man, his wife, and his children, and they were naked. Literally, I mean, there was not even the loincloths. They were naked. And they're standing there, and in this little village with all of their people that they had tried to minister to, the communists looked at the man and said, "You deny Christ, and we'll let you and your family live. If you will not deny Christ, you will die. Do you want to see your wife and children die?" And the little ones began to cry. And the man was just before renouncing. And his wife took her hand and she placed it on her husband's lips. And she looked down at the children and she said this. She said, "Hush, children, for tonight we dine with the King of Kings." And they shot that family and they fell into that hole and they buried them. And that church was born out of that man being killed and his wife and two kids being killed. In the 1980s, this church had over 250,000 members. We have nothing in this country that can compare. 250,000 members. And that was 30 years ago. I don't understand the ways of God sometimes. But I know that ultimately there's good that's going to come out of it. And there are times when God lets his people die so that good can come out of it. There's an old adage that came from ancient times, and it says that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. And you have people that died in the book of Acts, but yet God's work began to flourish. And what you have here is you've got a tragedy. You've got a horrific tragedy. And you've got a man that is an unbeliever killing the men of God and their families. And yet, God allowed it. And so we have persecution that is here. But then I want you to notice some protection. Look with me at verse 20. "And one of the sons of Ahimelech," what is his name? Abiathar. Well, how did Abiathar survive? Probably what happened is this. His dad probably left him in Nob to fulfill the duties until they got back. And so he was not among the 85 priests that were murdered. But let me tell you something, it doesn't take long for that kind of word to spread. And before Doeg can get back to Nob, he's hearing about it. And we don't really, we know that the writer of Samuel puts this in here so that we get a complete picture. But in reality, Abiathar will not really meet David until the 23rd chapter. But he tells us what's happened and why, because it helps us to complete the story here in chapter 22. And Abiathar showed David, or he told David, that Saul had slain the Lord's priest. But then I want you to notice what happens with David. "David said unto Abiathar, I knew it that day." Oh, I knew it that day. Look back with me at chapter 21. Look at chapter 21, verse 7. David has gone to Nob. And in Nob that day, there's a certain man that is detained there before the Lord, and his name was Doeg. and he belonged to the herdsman. He was the chief of the herdsmen of Saul. And David sees him and he goes, that's trouble. And now we are at the end of this chapter, and what does he say? I knew it that day. I just knew it. And he would surely tell Saul. And then he looks at Abiathar and he says this. He said, I've caused the death of all the persons of thy father's house. If I would have dealt with him when I saw him at Nob, all of these people wouldn't have died. And David says, it's on me. He accepts that he should have done something that day, or he should not even have gone in the first place. He knows he should have done something different, and he knows that he shouldn't have lied. And what you find is you find David, and he's accepting responsibility, which is totally different than anything that Saul does. Well, in verse 23, we see something. He says, abide thou with me, fear not. For he that seeketh my life, he seeks yours too. But with me, thou shalt be in safeguard. Just stay with me. Now, what do you have in David's life? And don't mistake in this. You got 400 men. There'll be 600 soon. You got 400 men. You got their wives and their children, and they are following David. And now they're beginning to see things come together. Why? Because there's a prophet named Gad. Oh, but now there's a priest named Abiathar. And so they know that God is with David. They know there's a priest with David. They know there's a prophet with David. They like where they're at because they know that with that, God's on their side. Now, we may see this next week. But Abiathar, when he comes, what does he bring with him? He brings the high priest breastplate. And what is on that breastplate? There's some stones on it called the Urim and the Thummim. And that's how many times in the Old Testament those priests would determine the will of God. Well, when Abiathar, when he leaves Nob, he brings that with him, and now God seems to be residing wherever David's at. And so, when David reflects on this, he writes a psalm. Flip over, if you would, and this will be our last thing for this evening. Flip over to Psalm 52. In Psalm 52, it's a little short psalm. The title says that it's a psalm of David when Doeg the Edomite came and told Saul and said unto him, David is come into the house of Ahimelech. Look at verse 1 and following. Why boasteth thyself in mischief, O mighty man? In other words, it's a rhetorical question to Doeg. All right? I want you to know something. The goodness of God endureth continually. Thy tongue deviseth mischiefs like a sharp razor working deceitfully. In other words, your tongue plans destruction, basically is what it's saying. Thou lovest evil more than good, lying rather than to speak righteousness. All Doeg had to say was this. Yeah, Ahimelech interceded for him. He gave him bread. He even gave him a sword. But all that time he thought that he was on your side. That's all he had to say. But no, he leaves out the part so that he can get gain. And speaking of that, when he killed all those people at Nob, anything that that was left, he got to be able to spoil it and take it for himself. Keep that in mind. That's one of the ways that people got paid in those days, was by what they could take after they had killed people. And he said, "You loved evil more than good, and lying rather than speaking righteousness. Thou lovest all devouring words, O thou deceitful tongue. God shall likewise destroy thee forever. He shall take thee away, pluck thee out of thy dwelling place, and root thee out of the land of the living, Selah." In verse number 5, it's a picture of a huge, powerful tree that has been felled. It's been cut down. Not only has it been cut down, but it's been cut up. It's been drug off, and it's been put in a fire, and it's been burned, and the roots dug up. It's a total destruction. And that's what David's saying about doing. He's saying, you're like a tree that's just wiped out totally. "And the righteous shall see and fear and shall laugh at him. Lo, this is the man that made not God his strength, but he trusted in the abundance of his riches, and he strengthened himself in his wickedness." But then David says this, "But I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I'm flourishing. I'm producing. Oh, God has got his blessings on me. Why? I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever. And I will praise thee forever because thou hast done it. And I will wait on thy name, for it is good before thy saints." A man after Saul's own heart. I pray to God that we'll never be like that. I want us to be a man after and a woman after God's own heart. May that be so. Let's stand together.